Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, Dutch trade union FNV have threatened legal action against football's governing body, FIFA, over the alleged mistreatment of migrant workers in Qatar, which has been referred to as, quote, modern-day slavery.
The Israeli army and police have staged a large-scale detention campaign across the West Bank, including the arrest of 8 children by Israeli security officials disguised as Palestinians. We get reaction from the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem to the latest security escalation in the region.
He was one of the most popular presidents of recent times. Some would even argue that he's one of the most popular politicians in the history of Brazil. But given all that, would a bid for the presidency by Lula da Silva be wise or even popular?
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has set out proposals to change the Hungarian constitution to ban settling a, quote, foreign population, as the changes would effectively reject the European Union's migrant quotas. We'll be asking if it's even legal within the EU framework to do so.
A Pakistani delegation to Washington has suggested that it is high time for the White House to play a greater role in ending the Indian occupation of Kashmir. But considering Washington's alliances with both of these countries, we ask how likely it is that Washington will pick a side.
And where is the best place to live in the United Kingdom? Well, you can find out at the end of the programme.
All that and more over the next half hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus. The Netherlands Trade Union Confederation, the FNV, has threatened to lodge a legal case against football's governing body, FIFA, over the alleged mistreatment of migrant workers in Qatar, which human rights groups have called, quote, modern slavery. In a letter to FIFA, the Dutch trade union described the plight of migrant workers in Qatar directly involved with the preparations of venues for the 2022 World Cup.
The FNV highlighted the case of a Bangladeshi worker, Nadeem Sharaful Alam, who is at the centre of the lawsuit. They state that Mr. Alam was lured to Qatar with a, quote, pretty tale, and even had to pay several thousand euros to a recruiter. He was then placed in a camp with thousands of other workers in what he described as dreadful conditions, had his passport taken from him, and was treated as a, quote, modern-day slave. The letter to FIFA also calls for the abolition of the kafala system, the Qatari employee law which allows employers to hold employees' passports and refuse their requests to leave the country.
Earlier I spoke with Minky Warden from the Human Rights Watch and asked if the experience of Nadeem Alam was in keeping with reports they themselves had received.
Yes, Human Rights Watch has done a report in 2012 about the long-standing problem, and it's in Qatar, but also, of course, across the entire Gulf area, of the so-called kafala system, which is a form of modern-day slavery. We and other organizations like Amnesty International have extensively documented how the kafala system is a violation of basic human rights. A sort of typical experience that a worker would have is exactly similar to that in the lawsuit. I think it's amazing that it's taken this long to have such a lawsuit. And, you know, the UN guiding principles on human rights are very clear about the need to do due diligence in advance of awarding something like the $200 billion World Cup. I think this is really a case where FIFA dropped the ball and needs to take immediate steps to rectify the situation.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the lawsuit is against FIFA. And do you think that it's fair for the lawsuit to be taken against FIFA, where they're not the ones that are employing the people?
FIFA is the organization that awarded the World Cup to Qatar. And as I just mentioned, the UN guiding principles on human rights are very clear. It says that you need to do a risk assessment in advance of awarding something that can actually cause or contribute to human rights abuses. In this case, the World Cup infrastructure was simply not there. As many of a dozen stadiums are being renovated or built, and all of this labor is with migrant workers workers who are being imported for that purpose. They do not have basic human rights in Qatar, including that even if they want to leave, they have to get permission from their employer. So there are a number of steps that FIFA could have and should have done. It's certainly not too late. I think it's also the case that FIFA is well aware of their responsibility in this area. Last year, FIFA commissioned a report from Professor John Ruggie of Harvard University, where John Ruggie made very clear in a 40-page report what responsibilities FIFA has and how the sports organization needs to act to remedy the abuses that are taking place in the country now.
Well, Minky Warden, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Glad to do it. Thank you for taking up this important topic.
The Israeli army has staged a large-scale detention campaign in Jerusalem and the West Bank. Reports in the Palestinian media said that 64 people, including 12 children, were arrested in a series of army raids. At one refugee camp in the West Bank, Israeli security officials disguised themselves as Palestinians carrying out the detentions. It follows clashes in the camp, with Israeli forces firing tear gas and rubber bullets at stone-throwing Palestinian youths. Liam O'Hare has more.
Aida refugee camp is located in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. It's surrounded on three sides by the separation barrier, what Palestinians call the apartheid wall. Yesterday, undercover Israeli officials raided the camp, arresting nine children. We contacted the Israeli Defence Force for a statement on the invasion, but they've not responded to requests. Mohammed Al-Azraq is the international coordinator for the Laji Centre and Aida refugee camp. He joins me on the line now. Mohammed, can you tell us what happened yesterday?
At the refugee camp, being like in under civil attacks by the Israeli occupation forces, yesterday a group of undercover Israeli army supported with some Israeli soldiers came into Aida camp, close to at the entrance of the camp, where a majority of kids and the only guardian of the camp, also the kid located there. So they took every kid or a person that was walking the street, kidnapped them, blindfolded them, and handcuffed them, and took them up to a military police. There's about nine people who have been arrested. Most of them are children aged between 13 to 17. There's only one of the people who are arrested who's 18 years old. All these kids have been sent to Al-Fara prison, which is a prison where it's like political prisoners and older prisoners even in the prison, and they've been kept until they will be sent to the courts one day. We don't know exactly when they will be sent to court or what reasons or what the Israel army accused them with. They all were playing, they were walking the streets. There's some, two of the kids were visiting a family in the camp, so they're not even from that area. They don't know what's going on, but they were walking in that street when the special forces came to kidnap the kids in the street.
Mohammed, a lot of people might be quite surprised listening in that this is children that were arrested.
Yeah, it's happening everywhere in Palestine. Like thousands of Palestinian children being arrested during the last 16 years and also before. Like that, the problem with the child arrest, like detention, and also with the problem with arrests, and like since like 67 started, like there's over 1 million Palestinians been imprisoned by the Israeli occupation since 1967, and there's like a very, very large number of kids been imprisoned for like days, weeks, months, and years. Like there's like some kids who've been like 13 and 14 years old being sentenced for like years, for years.
And can you give us an idea of the type of conditions that these people, that these children will be in when they're in jail?
Yeah, the first like thing is start with the detention. Like all of these kids, they've been arrested and kidnapped from their own homes. And Israeli army used early morning hours for detention. So they come to people's houses and at like 3, 4 in the morning, it breaks in the doors, taking kids from their beds and take them to prison. They beat them up, they abuse them, they use many like violent ways and like hard conditions to them. They've been locked in the same cells on same conditions that even adults adults they go through.
Well, Mohammed, obviously sounds like a very difficult situation for anyone to be living in. But thanks very much. We appreciate you speaking to us today on World in Focus.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme in just a moment, he was one of the most popular presidents of recent times. Some would even say he's one of the most popular politicians in the history of Brazil. But given all that, would a bid for the presidency in 2018 by Lula da Silva be wise or even popular?
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has set out proposals to change the Hungarian constitution to ban settling a, quote, foreign population. As the changes would effectively reject the European Union's migrant quotas, we'll be asking if it's even legal within the EU framework to do so.
A Pakistani delegation to Washington has suggested that it's high time for the White House to play a greater role in ending the Indian occupation of Kashmir. But considering Washington's alliances with both of these countries, we ask how likely it is that Washington will pick a side.
And the results are in. We can reveal, according to a brand new study by the European Commission, where the best place to live in the UK is. Of the campaign videos from Lula da Silva's 2002 presidential campaign there, Lula went on to win that election with a massive 61.3% of the vote, becoming the second most voted for president in the world, Ronald Reagan being the first. The former metal worker rose to prominence through the unions before running for president under the banner of the Workers' Party and is generally considered to be one of the most popular politicians in Brazil's history. And during his tenure as president, he was one of the most popular in the world.
It was, of course, Lula's protege, Dilma Rousseff, who succeeded him as president of Brazil before her controversial impeachment this year. And with her former vice president, Michel Temer, now firmly installed in her place, all eyes are beginning to turn towards 2018 and Brazil's next presidential election. The odds of Dilma Rousseff returning to the fray are slim, despite the fact that she wouldn't actually be barred from doing so. But there's been a lot of chatter ever since her impeachment of her mentor, Lula da Silva, taking another run for office.
So far, this is just rumour, but Lula has made noises to that effect over the past month, and it would undoubtedly throw a spanner into the works of the Temer administration, who are keen to draw a line under the years of Workers' Party rule. Brazil is divided at the moment, and whether the Workers' Party could win an election is still hard to gauge. But the return of Lula could just tip the scales.
With me on the line now is Dr. Fiona McCauley. She's a senior lecturer in development studies from the University of Bradford. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. McCauley. Do you think a Lula run in 2018 seems likely?
That's a difficult one. I mean, I think one of the problems that the PT has had is a succession problem, which is that you had a fantastically popular president who was also the founder of the party, who ran for the maximum and served for the maximum two consecutive terms that a president can in Brazil. And one of the problems, of course, was the Dilma Rousseff appointment, because he basically handpicked her as his successor, was that she was not a strong candidate to be president after him. And the more interesting question is, why wasn't there anybody of seniority after so many years of the party being in existence and running for office and governing states and governing major cities? Why was there nobody that was even of comparable stature to Lula that actually could have been chosen by the party in their internal selection process? And now the answer to that is that when Lula came into power in 2003, essentially they had done all kinds of things to fund their election campaign in order to get elected and to compete with the centre-right, who, of course, you know, big business was funding very generously. And the kinds of things that they did, like, you know, skimming off money off contracts in the cities that they ran and so forth, and also once they were in power, the fact that there were so many parties represented in Congress basically meant they had to pay congressmen to vote with them on particular policy issues. So all of that came to a sticky end very quickly in the middle of Lula's first term of office, with the result that several heavyweight politicians that you would think would have become his natural successors ended up under investigation for corruption and malfeasance and ended up in jail. So he's still in the same situation. The party is still in that situation where it doesn't have a clear, natural successor to Lula that has the kind of charisma, popularity, and so forth that he had. So if he's thinking about running again in order to, you know, rescue the PT, rescue his legacy, rescue the party, it's kind of from a position, well, A, of desperation, and B, I think that the party just hasn't got its act together to groom a decent successor to him.
Well, you say there as well that this would be an attempt to rescue his legacy. Do you think maybe there's a risk, though, that it could actually have the opposite effect? I mean, I was speaking just last week to some activists from Brazil who were very big fans of Lula back when he was president, and even they were saying, we don't really want him to run again because, you know, right now he's very popular, he's remembered. If he were to run again and become president again, especially in the current climate, inevitably he would not go down in history as the popular figure that he's become.
I think that's entirely correct. And I think that for him, a lot of what has happened in the last, you know, couple of years with the, you know, the taking down of Dilma Rousseff, and the fact that there have been allegations against him, I think some of which are spurious and some of which maybe are not, I think he really does see this as a legacy issue. I think that's what infuriates him, that, you know, he did do some good things for Brazil in terms of kind of income inequality and social rights and so on and so forth. But I also think that the country is now so divided. The PT now has become such an object of kind of hatred by particular sectors of the population. Whether rightly or wrongly, that just is a fact, that it is a very, very bitterly divided country. And he would, even if he won the election, let's assume for a minute that he had enough base of support as a kind of charismatic leader that he could do that, he would not be able to govern, because the party system now in Congress is fantastically fragmented, much more so than even than when he was president. There's now something like 30 parties represented in Congress. And these are not real parties. They're just basically labels that opportunistic individuals have used to get themselves elected. You know, and Congress is a bit of a bean feast at the moment. I mean, all the people who voted for Dilma Rousseff to be impeached, many, many, many of those have had their hands in the honeypot for a long time. If the PT's image now is fragile, it would be much, much worse, and there would be a situation of complete ungovernability if he were elected. Now, that was already happening under Rousseff, right? I mean, she had lost her ability to kind of use the levers of power, and the PT project had run its course, and it was beginning to look like they wanted to stay in power forever, which actually I think some people in the party kind of thought was a good idea. But, you know, in the end, you do get this incumbency fatigue. And you have to cede to another party for a while to regroup, rethink things and come back with a fresh set of promises. So, no, it would be a disaster. The PT needs a complete rethink of itself. And Lula is not going to be the saviour of the party.
I guess we shall see where it goes, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for talking to us, Dr. Fiona McCauley.
Okay, you're very welcome.
In the latest instalment in a long-running argument over European migrant quotas, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has set out proposals to change his country's constitution containing a ban on settling a, quote, foreign population in Hungary. The new proposals before Parliament would also ban foreigners from settling in Hungary unless they abide by the laws on obtaining residency. The move continues Orbán's tough stance against proposals by the European Commission to relocate 160,000 migrants from Greece and Italy to EU member states on a mandatory quota system.
Hungary held a referendum on the issue of immigration on October 2nd, in which 94.8% voted to reject the migrant quotas. However, since turnout did not exceed 50%, the result is invalid. But Orban has seized the result as backing for a change to the constitution. Sputnik's Jim Ensom has been following this story closely and joins us on the line. Jim, is it even legal within the EU framework for Hungary to refuse to accept refugees?
The funny thing about this is that the idea about relocating 160,000 from Greece and Italy to each EU member state was agreed at a summit in September 2015, at which Viktor Orban was. Now, the thing you need to know is that at EU summits, they don't take votes most of the time. They just simply agree a statement that's issued to the press and the world at the end of the summit. And he did not veto any word of it. So by implication, he was one of those who actually agreed to the relocation plan. He then jumps on the plane, goes back home to Budapest, and then rails against it. He's not the only one. Poland's against it. Slovakia, which holds the rotating presidency, is against it. So the question is of legality is being tested. Now, Slovakia and Hungary have both sent the whole thing back to the European Court of Justice anyway, saying they don't want the mandatory relocation of migrants. So the question of what's legal in all this goes back to the fuzzy business of how the EU actually works. Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the Commission, swears blind that this is EU policy. So does Donald Tusk, the president of the Council. And yet this goes back to the sovereignty of nations. And what Orbán is saying is, hang on a minute, we, as a sovereign nation, should have the right to decide it, not you. And that is what Brexit's about. And the same thing is being asked about Poland, who are doing exactly the same, and many of the other Eastern European countries who don't want to create, as Orbán is saying, foreign populations within their own countries.
Mm-hmm. So is it therefore quite unlikely that Hungary will face any repercussion or punishment from the EU for this?
Well, it's fascinating. Brussels is currently threatening Poland with sanctions. They can actually literally remove your voting rights in all the institutions. They're threatening Poland over a clampdown on media and media freedoms and also changes to their constitutional court. The same thing could be done, but I'll give you a clue. When Spain and Portugal were in breach of their fiscal rules in the Eurozone and they were told that they would have to be given significant fines, Europe backed down. I think the same is likely to happen here.
And as you were mentioning there, Viktor Orbán had the chance to veto this in the European Union and didn't. Is this very much a vote winner within Hungary, and he's trying to therefore just use this to cement support for him within the Hungarian public?
Well, if you remember, on October the 2nd, they held a referendum on whether or not quotas were in, and it was won by 94.8%. They all said, those who voted, said, no, we don't want migrant quotas. But because they failed to get a threshold of 50% turnout, that was in fact not binding. But Orbán says, hang on a minute, I don't care about that. Most popular opinion in my country is we don't want mandatory migrant quotas, and he's using that as his excuse to change the constitution, and there's going to be a fight on his hands.
Is there, just finally, do you think there's any validity to the idea that the low turnout, which was below 50%, which returned over 94% majority in favour of not taking on these quotas, that 50% that didn't turn up to vote arguably could be seen as a protest against the entire notion of not taking in refugees? Do you think many people just didn't vote in protest, and perhaps that's not the view of the general public in Hungary?
It's very difficult to know. Orbán knows public opinion is on his side overall, and you know, he's known that for quite some time, and there is general public opinion against it. I don't know why the turnout wasn't higher. Maybe the case wasn't done, maybe too many people complacent and thought that it was a done job. But whatever happens, although it is actually technically not binding under their law, he's taken this as being a positive signal that he should go ahead and make changes to the constitution.
Jim Ensom, very interesting speaking to you as always. Thank you.
Pakistan expressed serious concern last week to Washington over its lack of decisiveness in the Kashmir conflict. This is a particularly difficult issue for Washington as it maintains strong and important alliances with both Pakistan and India, both of whom have territorial claims over Kashmir. Matthew Aiton asks now how the dispute has affected Washington's relations with the two South Asian countries.
Pakistani envoys on a mission to Washington delivered a strict warning to the White House that ignoring the ongoing conflict in Kashmir could hinder US-Pakistani counter-terrorism efforts against the Taliban. To what extent Pakistan would actually be willing to see its joint operations with the United States wither is an intriguing question in and of itself, considering that the South Asian country relies on US support to battle its own internal terrorist problem. There is also mounting pressure from within the US for the White House to act against India for its conduct in Kashmir. Recently, a petition has been submitted to the White House to declare India a terrorist state. The petition submitted by Pakistani Americans claims that India is involved in terrorist activities in the occupied Kashmiri territories, as well as federally administered tribal territories and parts of the Balochistan in Pakistan's south. So far, the petition has accumulated 940,000 signatures, but needs to reach 1 million to be considered by the White House. However, Washington is caught between a rock and a hard place. While it has strong interests in keeping its counter-terrorism coordination and intelligence-sharing operations with Pakistan alive, it also maintains a long and fruitful bilateral relationship with India. Joint maritime training, war games, joint India-US development of India's nuclear facilities have all animated the US-India alliance, especially since Obama came to office. So how can Washington strike a balance with both of these geostrategically important allies? Joining me on the line now to try and answer that question is Kashmiri scholar and political activist Allah Fazili. Allah, thank you for talking to us. Can you start by telling us how the conflict in Kashmir has affected US relations with both Pakistan and India?
US has been involved in the Kashmir issue to a very large extent all these years. But then the dynamics of relations have changed, I think, a bit in past decade, where the United States has gone pretty much closer to India, maybe because of economic interests or other interests. But we also remember that it is the United States herself which has proposed the resolution for right to self-determination, and which I mean referendum, the people of Kashmir in United Nations in 1947, and United States have been part of that resolution. But over the period of time, and then over all these years during the Cold War era also, I think they have been all the time asking Pakistan favors for in different conflict regions, being be it Afghanistan or any other conflict-ridden part in world. In exchange of that, they will be actively involved in the resolution of Kashmir. And but then we don't see any concrete engagement then all these years, except for they have recently, I think they have recently come up with this statement by the State Department as well, that this is a dispute which they accept over these years, and also the decision should be taken by the considering the will of the people of Jammu and Kashmir. But beyond this, I don't think any active engagement which people can feel or perceive that they have been maybe on a diplomatic front or behind like a track to diplomacy or in any other involvement, they might be there and they have been all along. But then that is not being seen as an engagement which is actually affecting or which is challenging the India's role here in Kashmir.
I mean, this must be a particularly difficult situation for Washington, because it maintains important alliances with both Pakistan and India. I mean, what do you think Washington's options are in regards to Kashmir? Is it at all possible for it to play the role of an impartial broker, do you think?
I think people here have been looking for long that United States is going to play one day important role by challenging Indian narrative here in Kashmir and trying to help them in promise which the whole world has kind of a, when we talk of United Nations, so it is like whole world have promised people of Kashmir that they will be given chance to decide their own future. And all along, I think people in Kashmir have been looking up to West, not only West, but I think in more particularly towards United States, that they can at least pressurize India for the resolution of Kashmir. And options are very clear. They could have, there have been at least options, very simple options are there, at least asking India to accept the very disputed nature of Kashmir, which they are now negating, and then also helping in like pressurizing them to stop the unabated killings and atrocities and human rights, gross human rights violations for that matter. But then you don't see actually they have been doing it on that scale, which can be seen by people here and in, I think, in other parts of the world, that they are doing pretty much here.
Okay, Allah, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And finally, our more astute listeners will have noted by now that World in Focus broadcasts live from Edinburgh in Scotland. And ask anyone on the World in Focus team and they'll tell you that it's a lovely part of the world. Well, except from the ones who are from Glasgow. What everyone in Scotland will agree on, though, is that it's a lovely country. And now that opinion is apparently backed up with hard science.
Well, sort of. A new study by the European Commission has said that Scotland is the best country in the whole of the UK to live in, based on quality of life and the general welcoming attitude of Scots. It wasn't all good news, though. Apparently Scotland has some of the slowest broadband speeds in the UK.
I can believe that.
What's your favourite thing about Scotland, Jack?
Well, I wasn't sure about this. I was thinking maybe it could be oatcakes, but actually I decided tatty scones.
For international listeners, can you describe what a tatty scone is?
It's a scone made of potato.
But it doesn't look like a scone.
No, and it doesn't taste like a scone.
Or taste like potato,
really. It's like a sort
of
savoury potato mash fried thing. It's very nice. It reminds me a little bit of the elven bread in Lord of the Rings that keeps you fed for like 3 or 4 days or something.
I've never read Lord of the Rings. I don't know. But unfortunately, that's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In a moment, it's the Tom Hartman Show from Washington, D.C. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.